Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
In 2020, events have yet again shone a light on racial inequalities across the globe. Australia is not an exception. 20 years on from the reconciliation walks of the year 2000, this nation's journey towards a more just, equitable, and reconciled identity still has a long way to go. With that in mind and in the spirit of reconciliation, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea, and community. We pay our respects to their elders past, present, and emerging, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples today.
I ask the Prime Minister, how good is Australia?
Please explain.
Mate, this is just impossible.
Too many people were confused.
You bet you are. You bet I am.
I have always believed in miracles.
That's not a policy.
Not now. Not ever.
I mean,
these comments are completely inappropriate.
Oh, I'm sure she's right.
You know, but I ain't spending any time on it.
How pathetic.
You're a classic space invader.
Disgusting, mud-sucking creatures.
You should be ashamed of yourselves.
Oh, fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate.
Taste of democracy, very good.
G'day there and welcome to this week's Democracy Sausage Extra from the Policy Forum studio at the ANU's Crawford School of Public Policy. I'm Mark Kenny from the Australian Studies Institute, and can I just say regarding that we've just issued our second annual report. Under the signatures of the ANU's Pro Vice Chancellor for International Strategy, Professor Sally Wheeler, and the Aussie Director, Professor Paul Pickering. And it makes for some interesting reading about the multiple ways in which the ANU, via the Australian Studies Institute in particular, is consolidating the study of this country in politics, geography, the performing and visual arts and literature, and also coordinating the numerous Australian Studies centres around the world. And believe me, there are more of them than you think. And of course, Democracy Sausage features prominently there also, so check it out. Now, what could be more intrinsic to the understanding of Australia than its people, or rather its population? Where is it? Where's it been? And where might it go? What are the forces shaping our population? And are we slave to those forces, or can we shape them ourselves? I'm delighted to be talking this week to one of the foremost experts on this field. She goes by the name of Dr. Demography on Twitter, and she's the author of a captivating new book called The Story of Us, or alternatively, The Story of Australia. It's a warm welcome to the ANU's very own Dr. Liz Allen. Liz, welcome to what I'm rebranding for this special episode, Demography Sausage.
Oh, I love it. I love it. So I will have to pull you up on something. It's the future of us.
The future of us.
So within the book, I talk about the story of us, but the book in totality is referred to as the future of us.
Well, I'm a stickler for accuracy, except obviously in my own recommendation of the title. It's actually a much better title, The Future of Us.
It feels fitting. I think it was written and certainly kind of published before we really realised the impact of COVID, but it's still certainly very, very relevant and frames a conversation that I'm glad that we're having now in the current climate. Is that we hear the word unprecedented, you know, it's unprecedented times, it's we've never experienced this before, and that gives us opportunities as much as challenges to sit back and take stock of ourselves, who we are, our trajectory, I guess, and really where we want to be and how we're going to get there. And so it, while I never anticipated a pandemic to occur, it's probably a good time to be considering the future of us, the future of Australia.
It's a very good time. Of course, it's a very unsettling time as well, because the hardest thing to understand in terms of the historical weight of something, the hardest time to do it is during that event. It's very difficult to contextualize it. I mean, we can understand it in ways that people who aren't here, weren't here, will never understand because we're experiencing it, we're living through this. But we can't necessarily understand it in its longer term historical context yet. So this is a real kind of challenge to understand how do you make policy from here, and how long reach or long running are the implications of the things that are happening now, the changes that are being wrought, and also the policy responses that are thought up in the process.
So the cool thing for me about demography, and I like the kind of visual concept of sausages being made kind of in a factory. That's what I visualize right now, this idea of, you know, we look back and demography enables us to, you know, think of the kind of the pipeline of a sausage and series of sausages being made. We can look to past occurrences and past population changes and
shocks
and the
lot.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And socioeconomic shocks in the same kind of vein. And that allows us to learn lessons from those and then take those lessons and apply them to the now and then kind of stand here right at the now, hot sausages in hand, to the future of where we might be. And if we look to what the most similar circumstances that have occurred in the past to where we are now, we've got the Great Depression, of course, to refer back to, and kind of periods around war, but also there are so many similarities around the so-called Spanish influenza of 1919 in Australia and how it affected us here, that we can then borrow and hold tight those sausages neatly packed and consider how we might respond to things that we're not certain may or may not happen. So this kind of we're in this period of great uncertainty when it comes to data, when it comes to what's actually happening, right? We just have to look to Melbourne to consider that great anticipation that people kind of, you know, take hold of their breath and think, what are the numbers today?
Yeah.
That uncertainty kind of makes us stop and pause and shift into survival mode. So it kind of stifles any ability to plan while we're still dealing with something so now and so raw and you know, it's a matter of life and death.
It's so unquantified in a way because you don't know how it ends, right? So that's
actually
one of the critical
things. We don't know if it will end, right? That's what we're faced with right now.
Yeah.
And I think that demography, I might be a little bit biased, but demography allows us a superpower of sorts to consider these things. How have we responded in the past in terms of population dynamics, births, deaths, population movements, and how might we be able to learn from that and apply it to the now?
Well, let's be really basic about this. Demography, can you give us a good sort of working description of what demography is?
Demography, if I give you the kind of undergraduate 101 kind of explanation
that's
of demography.
That's about the level I'm operating at.
It's raw. It's really boring and stale, right? Demography is about understanding the characteristics, composition and location of population across geography, basically. So as a demographer, I'm interested in knowing about population dynamics of change, which are births, deaths, and migration, and what a population is composed of in terms of age and sex distribution, socioeconomic distribution, and how that plays out and how that might influence or translate other behaviours like gender norms, family dynamics, and our everyday interactions that describe how our circumstances of our birth and our demographic characteristics kind of influence who we are and how we behave and what we do. So take, for example, something I'm keenly interested in, given my own particular background as a single point of demography, is this idea that we know from the literature that and from previous research that there's very little social mobility. That is, that the circumstances of your birth, the circumstances of your parents, the socioeconomic circumstances of your parents, determines much of your life, the trajectory of your life course, your level of education, your income, your social standing. And that to me is quite jarring, this idea, you know, here demography is destiny. At an individual level, we certainly see that to some degree. And I think in Australia, we like to think we're fair and that people, if you have a go, you get a go and you'll be right, mate.
We like to think we're fair and we also like to think we're sort of classless.
And it's not true. And it's not true. And that's something that I think as a former poor kid who has, you know, experienced disadvantage.
But who now has a PhD. So in a sense, you buck that trend.
I'm a deviant. I am a deviant. I'm one of – and it's actually known. It's known as a deviant case, one that's dropped out and gone against the grain. That carries some responsibility, right, that I speak for those that are left behind. But here's the thing about poverty and disadvantage is that it never leaves you. So I'm also a teen mum. I'm no longer a teen. But I still say I'm a teen mum. Why? Because there are epigenetic factors that come with those experiences early in life and even before your birth that influence you as a kind of genetic person in space. And it changes the way that your brain processes, kind of the cognitive processes of scarcity. So there's, you know, there's a saying that, and a belief certainly that poor people are dumb when it comes to money. Poor people aren't dumb when it comes to money. Again, research shows that what happens is when you're faced with scarcity, your cognitive processes change because you're so caught up in trying to survive that you don't focus on or you cannot focus on outward looking and that stays with you.
Because those outward looking things are much more abstract. They're far less tangible. The idea of an overseas holiday or a new car next year or of saving for your retirement or whatever, these are quite secondary to a much more hand-to-mouth existence. And so, in a sense, they're quite abstract.
You may not get to retirement.
Precisely.
Right? And that's the thing is that when you're surviving and you're thinking about how am I going to live today, tomorrow, or feed my kids, you're not thinking about a holiday because odds are you ain't getting one.
No.
And well,
you don't really imagine it.
No, because it's not a possibility. You're talking about the fundamental of survival. And I think that...
And that changes also where you seek your pleasure. I mean,
exactly,
as we all need to. Whether
exactly.
It be in food or sometimes in alcohol,
but drugs,
because that people need relief from their circumstances and the harsher the circumstances, the more they need relief.
That's right. But instead of understanding and stepping back and understanding the demographic kind of aspects that underpin those structural factors, we instead demonize individuals. Yeah. You are a deficit. There's something wrong with you if you are born into a particular set of circumstances and can't get out. So you're right. I'm a PhD. I work at a university. You could perhaps call me an elitist, but I don't feel that. I talk different.
You don't sound like an elitist to me.
No. I'm a yobbo from the western suburbs of Sydney who went to Mount Druitt TAFE and, learned about life on the streets, so to speak, you know. And that's something that I carry with great responsibility but great delight almost that I survived and I can make a difference using my demographic superpower and my cape.
you survived and you prevailed and you haven't left that behind. I mean, as you say, there are, your argument is that there are some cognitive characteristics of that background which you recognize in yourself and which which never leave you. But you're not trying to leave them either. You're being quite open and honest about that, and I think that's very refreshing.
And here, look, I'm going to give you a complete insight into myself. At the supermarket, when you've experienced poverty, you shop differently. It's a totally different experience. It's a stressful experience. You go through and I need to wear glasses, but I don't wear my glasses when I go shopping because I know where things are in my local supermarket and I don't want to be distracted by other things that could be. So I go straight to what's needed and I leave. And at the checkout, I always go in and I'm feeling it coming on now, sweating palms. Really? I get beads of sweat, fearful that my card is going to be rejected. And it's like almost like a post-traumatic stress experience, this fear of not being able to make ends meet. And the sad thing is that we like to think we're in a classless society, a fair society where we're all together in Australia. The reality is that that's not the case. And more so, if we even think about a place like Canberra, everyone thinks that the ACT is, you know, this kind of really wealthy area.
Homogenised kind of middle-class community.
They're all working in government and they're all doing great and they all own homes and multiple properties. It hides inequality in a really pernicious way, in a way that traps and kind of confines and compresses people down because it's hidden. We can't acknowledge it and we can't help. So take, for example, at school, if you're a kid who is kind of among those living in hidden poverty in an area, you might be considered homeless based on the characteristics of the census because you're in an overcrowded house or an unstable circumstances. You might be couch surfing. And you go to school in an area that's kind of well-to-do purely by the postcode of your, could be a public school. And they go, okay, we're going to do a band tour to Melbourne, which a lot of Canberra schools do, obviously not in COVID. So there are small mercies, I guess, of COVID. And it's going to cost you $1,000 and you've got to pay it by blah, blah, blah date. And then the kid who's probably never been on a camp doesn't go again. And it's never noticed why that kid doesn't go. Never afforded the opportunities that the rest of the kids at that school are afforded.
And that kid then is aware of all the stories that come out of that camp that become the currency of exchange between his or her school friends after that for months and months afterwards and wasn't there and is very conscious of it all the time.
And you've pinpointed a really significant thing about Australian society. It's who you know, not what you know. And unfortunately, we still see the importance of networks. You know, what school did you go to? What college were you in when you're at university? Who did you hang out with? And we just have to look at the politicians in key positions who, you know, the front bench to actually see networks in action. The university you went to, the family name that you carry. We don't see poor kids in or people that look different in positions of power for a reason, and that's because they don't get a go. There's no such thing as if you get a go, if you have a go, you get a go. It's not about how hard you work because these poor kids are working bloody hard to survive. I liken it to running to stand still. Thank you, you two, for that quote. Good song, by the way. We need to take stock of that, and now's the time. We've got this opportunity to do that.
One of the phrases you mentioned a minute ago was demography is destiny, which of course Peter Costello made famous.
Yes.
And he was making a valid enough point.
Mm.
But you go further than that, don't you? You say that it's not just about it shaping us, it's about our ability to use demography to shape the national story or the future of us, as you have said in your book.
So here's the thing. It was – so Peter Costello borrowed that saying.
I figured he probably had. Most politicians don't take
that's right. And
things.
He didn't quote – he didn't give a citation. So undergraduate 101, always give citation, people. You'll find yourself in trouble. But it's been around for a long while. And this idea that – and it comes from, if we know the characteristics of our population, we can then see into the future somewhat and project, or even – and I hate the word predict. Don't say prediction when we're talking about demography. But anyway, I'll use it now. Okay. This idea that we can might see where we're going, right? So in that our demographic characteristics destine us for a particular outcome. A lot of people kind of poop on that idea, and there are elements of truth in it, yes, in that the characteristics of our population are important to where we're going.
But it's not the full story.
It's not the full story. And it's not the full story, and it shouldn't be the full story at an individual level. We should not be destined by the circumstances of our birth.
So we're not captive to our
past. We shouldn't be, but we are. So here's the thing. I want demography to be more than destiny. I want demography, and it should be, because it is for me. You know, imagine Liz sitting at the microphone right now, swishing her hair back, standing tall and wearing a cape. That's what demography should be, a superpower, a strength, where we look at the characteristics of our population. We look at and take stock at where we're doing well, how we're doing poorly. We identify those things. And then we seek structural remedies to that. How can we better support people to get out of their circumstances, to be a deviant, so that deviance is no longer a technical term when we're talking about people that drop out of poverty and become someone who is recognized as a world leader in whatever field. And I want people to be able to see demography as more than destiny. We can reshape our story, and we can harness and make good of the challenges that we're faced with by shifting to them to opportunities. But we need leadership, and we need commitment to do that.
And we need, in the end, we need participation by everyone, and in which case we could maybe coin a new term, demography is democracy.
Ah, well, there you go. That sounds like a really good podcast.
It does.
Hint, hint. And you know what? Population underlies everything. And without an understanding of demography, we kind of undersell ourselves in that we kind of miss a key part of the story, if not the story. And so understanding demography is an understanding of us.
Let's take a quick break there and come back in a moment with Dr. Liz Allen, who is giving us a very fascinating tutorial on demography.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hi, I'm Sharon Bessel. Policy Forum Pod is the podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy challenges facing Australia and its region. Each week we bring together expert analysis to tackle the big issues facing our region and to propose policy solutions. It's insightful, it's positive, and it's always fun. Policy Forum Pod is out every Friday. You can find it on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Or find us at policyforum.net/podcasts.
Welcome back. Now we're talking with Dr. Liz Allen about demography, of course, in this what we've rebranded Demography Sausage episode. Now, Australia's population sits currently at what, sort of somewhere north of 25 million.
Mm-hmm.
That's been a fairly rapid growth. I remember Kevin Rudd getting into a bit of trouble a while ago when he was Prime Minister, of course, for celebrating this rapid growth and saying, I'm in favour of a big Australia,
That's
I think
right.
was his term.
Mm.
That's kind of happening anyway, isn't it? we're growing, although we then have the advent of COVID. So
yes.
What are the forces that have driven our population growth quite rapidly in recent years? Obviously it's immigration, right?
So if we look at the kind of the way the population changes, the way the population grows, there's this thing called a balancing equation. We've got on one side, we've got natural increase, which is the difference between births and deaths. And then on the other side, we've got net immigration, net overseas immigration. So the out, the in versus the out. Mm. So if we look at kind of our most recent history, Australia has grown largely due to that net immigration, the net overseas immigration.
So component. We've had more people coming in than leaving Australia to live in other parts of the world.
That's right. And it's taken up a larger share of that balancing equation versus natural increase.
Right.
So our growth is more due to net overseas migration than to births, to natural increase within the population. Now, I want to be very specific here in that we really like to look at overall numbers. We like to look at what number of population we are right now and our growth rates. It's not those sorts of things that we should be paying a lot of attention to, but rather the composition of our population. What are we made up of in terms of our age distribution? Why is that important? Well, our current way of doing the economy is that we require people, a particular kind of relative proportion of people in the workforce to contribute to the finite pool of cash that the government uses to afford to pay for vital and essential infrastructure and services. At the moment, we're faced with more exits from the workforce than entrants. And so our very, very tightly kind of managed migration program in Australia fills that deficit, any potential deficit there, which is why we're seeing net overseas migration as a larger share because of our demographic characteristics. Now,
And also because our birth rate, our fertility rate, as it's often referred to, is actually in decline, as it has been in many other parts of the world, but ours has come off quite quickly. I think I was reading numbers the other day that said above 2 births per woman early this century, like as in 2002, but it's dropped now to what, 1.74 births.
That's
per
right. Woman. So we have in Australia, we are considered below replacement level fertility, and in demography, fertility is the outcome of a live birth. Another cool word, fecundity. Mm-hmm. Say it fast to hundreds of undergrads and it's like really funny. Mm-hmm. I love to do that, by the way, but that's an aside point. Fecundity is when we talk, that's the kind of lay term of fertility when we're talking about being fecund or able to have children. So when we say fertility in demography, we're talking about the outcome of a live birth. So yes, we're below replacement level, which is 2.1 around considered. And we've seen our kind of trend overall go downward, stabilizing a little bit, but I anticipate
and
that
that's pre-COVID,
that's exactly right. Pre-COVID, I do suspect that, we're going to see fertility rates decline. And that's because this uncertainty, the scarcity, you can't even get your loo roll, needs met. People have lost their jobs, they've lost their entitlements. They might be delaying or perhaps even foregoing having children during this period.
Well, let's come to that because some people have read some of the indicators and come to precisely the opposite conclusion. They've seen, I don't mean demographers, I mean, because you looked shocked then.
People on Twitter maybe.
Perhaps. But people on Twitter are people.
That's it.
But I'm thinking...
Sorry, I just had this image. Are they all one?
Well, not all of them. Actually, that's a very good point. Some of the people on Twitter. Well, put it this way. They've cited things like an increase in the purchasing of pregnancy tests, an increase in the use of dating apps, an increase in the use of or sales in some adult stores.
Yes.
And overlaying on all of that, I guess, an assumption about people having a lot more time at home.
Yeah.
And perhaps procreating.
Yeah.
Now, there's a difference, of course, between sex and procreation.
There is.
In our species, at least.
Which is an entirely different podcast, which would be very interesting. It is.
That's Democracy Sausage After Dark, which comes on later.
That's a different kind of, yeah.
It's a subscriber edition. But anyway, you can take those indicators and come to precisely the opposite conclusion from the one I've just drawn, can't you? I mean, people may be getting pregnancy tests because they're worried about being pregnant, not because they're trying to get pregnant.
Or because they're not seeing their doctor because they're not allowed to go into their doctor's surgery or they want to avoid the doctor. So pregnancy test sales, according to some retailers, they've increased. But we're in a period of telehealth where that's the go. And you're right, some people might want to know as a way to avoid being pregnant or to seek out an abortion early, or because they want to rejoice in being pregnant, but they don't want to rejoice by going to the doctor and getting COVID. That's the kind of thinking. The other thing too is that where, you know, you said, so we've got on one side, we've got pregnancy tests increasing. We've got this idea that dating apps are, you know, people are going gung-ho on dating apps. Thing is, they're not going gung-ho physically.
Which is a sort of a basic requirement for procreation.
Exactly. And that comes to the ingredients necessary for a baby boom.
Yes.
We're not going to have a COVID baby boom. It's unlikely we'll be able to refer to a boom as coronials or whatever, even though that sounds morbid, but also fun.
Name,
yes, it is. But because we lack the necessary ingredients of a boom above expected trend. Okay, so what does that mean? We need more people to partner and more people to be using less contraception, okay? And we don't see that. So, in fact, if we look at partnering, people are unable to partner because of the lockdowns. Even if they're doing it via an app, they're not doing it physically. And that kind of couples with this idea that sex shops are doing a roaring trade because people aren't necessarily going out and seeing and meeting a physical partner, or they're having fun with their present one, which always, you know, that doesn't necessarily end in baby. Where are we? I've got completely mind-boggled by the idea of
somewhere in the bedroom,
after dark.
I think.
The other one is contraception, and we know that contraception sales has increased.
Right, that does tend to mitigate against
exactly. And there was an issue, I recall, at the beginning of the COVID kind of thing, people in Singapore were taking photos of empty shells of condoms and saying, holy cow, we're in a crisis, because the manufacturing of the concern was that people weren't able to keep up with the normal need for condoms. But in actual fact, what it was because people were buying more because disposable gloves weren't in stock.
Yes.
So they were walking around with lubricated condoms on their fingers.
No wonder they couldn't partner up. It's pretty uncharming.
They were too slippery, but they were using it.
To press lift buttons.
To press lift buttons and things like that to avoid touching communal. So it was a barrier used for a good purpose, I guess. But so we don't have those necessary ingredients for a boom. And what the other thing too is, you probably don't want a baby boom right now.
Well, let's go to that, because what is the 1919, as you called it, the Spanish influenza, as it was, you know, it's a rather poor name for it.
Yeah,
but that's
it is
how
very
that's
poor
how
name.
It's known.
Yeah.
What does that tell us? Was there a slump then? I know it's a sort of a different world. It's 100 years ago, but
Do you know what? If we the better comparison here with regard to birth rates is because we've got a better data period, is the Great Depression,
right? Because it's actually about the economic dislocation rather than necessarily the virus, isn't it?
Exactly, perfectly said. And so if we look at the Great Depression. Think about the time there. We did not have reliable contraception, and yet people were delaying having children or having fewer children during that period. If we look at the period of the Great Depression, birth rates fell very swiftly, and we never ever saw a rebound to the lengths that we we had prior. So it's based on that information, based on the kind of the socioeconomic situation that we're in now, we're learning from the demography of the past to inform our expectations of the future. So I suspect, and the other thing too is that IVF, it's a non-essential surgery, it's classified as that. And as a result of that, it's an elective thing, and so people have not been able to access IVF as they normally would.
And that's presumably devastating some couples, because some of them are operating right at the end of that fertility window, and this is their last best hope, and suddenly it's denied them.
It's gone. And that's, for me, that's... As a, imagine that would be devastating. And we know already from survey data from HILDA, the Housing Income Labour Dynamics in Australia survey, that people generally in Australia don't achieve their desired or intended fertility outcomes anyway, because life gets in the way. And so, you know.
And we know that economic insecurity just leads people to postpone. Now, there's some evidence, I think, that you point to that. That postponement, even if it is intended as a postponement, ends up being permanent.
That's right. Because
it has a permanent effect on the overall family size.
That's exactly right. So in Australia at the moment, where we differ from the 1930s is that people have delayed having childbirth, starting a family rather, very, you know, until they're comfortable. And in doing so, kind of the window of opportunity with regard to fecundity is shortened. So that already kind of constrains opportunities as well. So we're faced with what I think really is a perfect storm for kind of demographic trouble.
And right at that moment, of course, we've stopped people coming into this country.
Exactly.
So this is a double hit in that sense, isn't it?
Yep. And so remember what I said is we've got fewer people going into the workforce than coming out. It's going to mean that we're going to have to reprioritize spending. And it's going to be, you know, think of your household budget. You have to prioritize what you can spend your money on. And without any, in the absence of any kind of crazy or fantastical shift in the way that we do monetary policy in Australia, we have to consider that that's how we're going to do budgets, right? And at the moment, budgets have been done in a way to favour one's re-election bids. And as a result of that, younger people have sacrificed and been the sacrifice, right? Home ownership is going down. Job security is an issue. We've got this kind of perfect storm on so many levels that bearing the brunt of the future of us are young people. Young people who are not going to be able to balance work and family, who aren't going to be able to achieve the dream of what generations past have achieved. And so we are at serious risk of having our living standards go backwards.
Yeah, and the assumption of rising living standards has underpinned virtually everything we've done. Certainly since the war.
Yeah.
This idea that we are continuously growing, except for the odd deviant year where we've had a recession. You know, which has happened for Australia relatively infrequently. And the assumption has been that we are growing as an economy and that our living standards are generally increasing. And that the threat now is that may, in fact, there may be structural changes that are being exposed right now.
Yes.
And that will result in that assumption being overturned.
Exactly. And I think for me, if we look at take this idea of inequality. We are faced with inequality becoming more entrenched and the difference between the haves and the have-nots getting greater, okay? The gap is widening. Why? Because at the moment we've got these perverse tax incentives that favour those wealthy and the networks and families of wealthy people.
They favour multiple property owners over people who've got no property at all.
People who are renting are funding the property portfolios of the wealthy. And that it doesn't seem fair.
And so what we could be looking at is with this increasing economic disparity, this unfairness, increasing political instability.
Yeah, well, and so if we look at not so much political instability, it's political ways. So I fear that COVID is being weaponized for political purposes. It's being used to further entrench a particular view of the world, and that is that more of a kind of a backward facing view of the world, and more importantly, an avoidance of reform, of real reform. We have a problem with reform generally in Australia. It's frightening and no one likes to do it, and we don't do it because it's not favourable to the electorates. We are faced now with our lack of kind of movement, so a stagnation in the way that we operate in the world and the way that we operate among ourselves, where we're just going to be constantly kind of navel-gazing or looking backwards and not standing on the now, thinking about and taking stock of us and our the problems with us, putting on our cape, swishing our hair back, standing tall and going, okay, this is what needs to be done. We need leadership to get this reform done so that we can leave this earth, this place at the end of our lives and go, you know what? We made a difference and we just didn't think for ourselves and we left nobody behind.
Well, that's it's a great aspiration to have, but as you say, it's pretty hard to see our policymakers rising to that challenge, at least rising fully to it. There have been, to be fair, some fairly significant transformations on the part of our political leaders. The current government, for example, has gone from a kind of a small government, everything was about sort of driving the tax down, base down, and having budget surpluses as if that was an end in itself. And they've become hyper Keynesians. They've had to be, they've had to borrow vast sums of money and pump that directly into the economy. And there is a recognition, I think, across the political establishment that the old ways aren't going to come back, at least not fully and certainly not in the short term.
I think definitely, as you say, in the short term, we're doing what we need to do to survive. My concern is the kind of the enduring, what we're going to do from here on. And as I say, I think this is a fabulous opportunity to take stock and consider as we need to reprioritise things, where we're going to be.
What about at a more granular level? Do you expect that there'll be long-term changes in the way we run our households, for example? I mean, there are a lot of households that have been forced into a restructure, if I can put it like that, people working from home. There are a lot of dads, for example, who've had a crash course in the excruciating stress of being at home and managing sometimes multiple children and the schooling thereof and other things. And on the plus side, seeing the advantages of being more involved on a daily basis in their families. Is it possible that we'll see changes there, attitudinal changes?
If we look to some of the data that has come out during the COVID period around gender equality and the negotiation of family duties and things like that, there are positive signs, but there's also the same old. Women have disproportionately lost their jobs, and are still disproportionately doing the large share of the juggle of family work and care. So the burden has fallen to women. But again, there are opportunities in that. We've shown again that there are failings within our societal structure that means that women bear the brunt of that. And instead of kind of thinking about, how are we going to help mothers, we need to shift our focus and consider how are we going to help parents. And that means childcare and greater provisions for childcare, more accessible childcare, making workplaces more family friendly, and kind of slowly, I think we're going to see as a result of COVID, changing social norms around caregiving and around that kind of the mental load that women bear as well. But it's going to be slow, and again, it's going to require leadership.
Is there a challenge here for scholars, for social researchers to be very clear here in how they communicate? Because it is a historic moment. These are stresses and weaknesses in the political economy which we are having laid bare for us by this crisis. There's always a million ways you can change something, and there's only one way to keep it the same. And that's why inertia so often wins.
It's easy.
Because there's multiple competing routes. But isn't it, doesn't the responsibility now fall on the academy and on social commentators to find a language for our policymakers, for our leaders, that animates them, that motivates them, that they can understand? The sort of changes you're talking about, recognizing the role that women are playing in the economy and how vulnerable they've been as being part of this precariat that don't have secure work. All of these things need to be, I guess, in some ways interpreted in econo-speak. How do we liberate the economic potential of all of these actors within the economy for the social good, for the social and economic good? It's not just about a bunch of lefties saying, you Liberal Party need to listen to our moral, you know, sort of come up onto our higher moral plane. It's about actually saying, look, there's a whole lot of underutilization going on here, a whole lot of exploitation, underutilization. There's free work being done. And there are ways in which this can all be much more efficiently organized.
And there are so many issues that you bring up there. And you're right, we need the academy needs to be better at translating research. But at the same time, we've had particular elements of the academy saying the same things over and over again and nobody listening.
Yeah, being right doesn't matter.
Exactly.
It hasn't mattered
on facts,
climate.
Who needs facts when you got the feels, right, really?
Yeah.
And the other thing too is our higher education sector is being completely smashed.
Hammered, yeah.
Completely smashed. And so, we've got so many perfect storms erupting that really lead to a lot of uncertainty.
It's an exciting time to be a scholar, though.
It is.
You know, witnessing from the inside, really, this epochal moment, if I can put it like that.
Yeah.
Liz Allen, it's been absolutely terrific having you on this special demography sausage. I'm delighting in saying that. It's been a terrific discussion, and we'll look forward to talking to you again.
Look, I'm very enthused by the idea of the After Dark, but also a little bit frightened.
You're not the only one. I don't know how it works for radio either. Sounds like a sleaze fest.
It does.
All right. Thank you very much for being on here. And thank you for listening to Democracy Sausage Extra this week. And I'll be back early next week with another episode. Until then, bye for now.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.